This episode of Social Flight Live is made possible by Avemco Insurance. Mention Social Flight for a 5% insurance discount at Avemco.com, subject to terms and conditions.
Welcome to the Social Flight Live podcast, an audio version of our live show, hosted every Tuesday evening at 8 p.m. Eastern at SocialFlightLive.com. Social Flight is brought to you by Aspen Avionics, Avidyne, Continental Aerospace Technologies, Lightspeed Aviation, Tempest Aero Group, and Whip Air. And now, here's your host, Jeff Simon.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to Social Flight Live. I'm Jeff Simon. We have an inspiring show for you this evening. Captain Heidi Hort is here. We're going to talk about her amazing career as a ferry pilot and airline pilot, as well as her amazing story of survival after ditching in the Pacific Ocean. Before we get started, just a few things. Well, first of all, things are booming inside Social Flight. Go to socialflight.com or the free Social Flight mobile apps for Apple and Android devices. We have tens of thousands of aviation events and destinations, all sorts of cool things, haunted hangars. We've got events that are starting to come with pumpkin drops and things for fall, things for the holidays. If you want to find something really cool going on, check out socialflight.com. You can also play our Fly to Win Challenge. And then that is, we just gave away a Lightspeed Delta Zulu headset on October 1st. And we've got another one that we are giving away now on December 1st. All you need to do is get the Social Flight mobile app, check in at your local airport. If you check in at multiple airports, get more points. You can get more entries in that contest. And we're just here to support general aviation. Lastly, our FAA Learning Center inside Social Flight has all sorts of courses you can take for wings credit, as well as aviation maintenance technician, or if you are a mechanic with an inspection authorization, you can take your 8 hours of recurring education through Social Flight. So check all of that out. Tonight's broadcast is brought to us by Whip Air, their amazing line of Whipline line of floats. If you haven't had a chance to go visit their factory in South St. Paul, Minnesota, it is absolutely spectacular. I have visited it. It's fantastic. Check it out. You get to see how these enormous floats are made. Their avionics shop, paint, interior, maintenance, everything you can imagine that's there. And they just got new certifications for their Yukon propeller that's made by Hartzell that does some pretty cool things on caravans. So check all of that out. And thanks so much to Whip Air for helping make this show possible. Now, on to tonight's guest. Heidi Porch is a retired Delta Airlines pilot whose 35-year career took her from the flight deck of DC-9s through the Airbus family of jets and even commanding the iconic Boeing 747-400. However, her pursuit of the flight levels began the scrappy way, ferrying single-engine Cessnas from the factory in Wichita to California, and then across the Pacific Ocean to Australia and New Zealand. As you might imagine, her career has included more than a few adventures along the way, and we're going to chat about a few of those tonight. However, one in particular tested every ounce of skill, nerve, and luck that she had available. While ferrying a Cessna 182 across the Pacific, her engine failed while still 540 miles east of Hawaii, forcing her to ditch in the vast Pacific Ocean. Her story is a lesson of skill, determination, and survival documented in detail in her book, Ditching the Sky. I am thrilled to have her with us there tonight. Please welcome to Social Flight Live, Heidi Porch. How are you doing, Heidi?
I'm doing great. Thank you.
Thank you so much for joining us. And I also want to send a quick thank you out to Diane Titterington, the Aviation Speakers Bureau. For any of you out there that are looking for speakers for your corporate event or anything else, go to aviationspeakers.com. Diane is absolutely fascinating. And Heidi, I'm thrilled that you're here. And before we really get into the story that makes up so much of the drama, I think, of your career, I'd like to start with how you got started, because you came up during a very interesting time in aviation. You really had to push your way in and make your mark. Tell me a little bit about what made that happen.
My father owned a Cessna 170 when I was very small. So he and I would go flying on the weekends, and I'd have to sit on a couple of phone books so I could see out the window. And I just became an airport bum at a very young age, just gravitated towards that. And then we took an airline flight back to Detroit from California. And during the flight, I noticed the stewardesses, they were stewardesses back then, going in and out of the cockpit, and the captain would come out and he'd drink coffee and they'd go back and forth. And I was talking to my dad and I said, "Dad, when I grow up, I'm going to be a stewardess." You know, he said, "Well, why?" And I said, "Oh gosh, they get to serve drinks and meals, and they get to take coffee up front. They get to drive the airplane, all that." And he goes, no, they don't get to drive the airplane." I go, "Yes, they do. They're all taking turns, you know." He goes, "No, Heidi, only the pilots fly the airplane." I go, "Okay, I'm going to be an airline pilot when I grow up." And that was it. That was it. I never changed my mind, and just always hung out at airports, and it chose me. I didn't choose it.
So what was your path in? That wasn't an easy time for a woman to find their way on all the way onto a flight deck.
I started at a glider port locally, and because you can get your glider license at a younger age than power, and it was cheaper. And so I started the glider port, ended up with a commercial glider license so I could give rides. And I'm really glad I started in gliders, because it's just the basics of flight. You don't have the distractions of an engine or the radios or anything like that. And you really get attuned to lift and turbulence, and you have to make that first landing count because you can't go around. So it gave me a discipline, and that carried over to my power flying. And then we moved. My father was an avionics engineer, and we moved back to Cedar Rapids, Iowa. And that's where I got my power private license there.
I know that when you did that, you also focused on tail dragger, and it seems like glider to tail dragger to, you know, moving through that, that really is, as you mentioned, the fundamentals of how to truly understand how an aircraft flies.
Right. We ended up going back to California. And so I went back to the glider port. And of course, I wanted to fly airplanes. I didn't want to fly gliders anymore. And so I was able, with the help of a mentor, a second father to me, got to fly the tail draggers and tow gliders. So I could do 20, 25 landings a day. And wow. And tail draggers, as you know, tend to ground loop if you're not, you know, you fly it till it stops, not after you land. So it's a handful. It was good experience. Yeah. And then from there, on the side, I was working towards my commercial instrument multi-engine and that along the way.
And so what was the first opportunity after, if we say that, you know, glider towing perhaps was, you know, the first professional job, what was the first time that you were flying for hire other than that towing?
I was going to go the normal route and become a flight instructor. That's what most people do. But a company moved into the local airport, the Nutrie Airport in Vacaville, California, which is near Travis Air Force Base. And they were a ferry outfit called Transair. And they had a contract with the Cessna distributors in Australia and New Zealand. They don't make airplanes down there. So all the airplanes that end up in those countries come from mostly the United States. So I didn't have the right amount of hours that they required. I was a little short, but I said, "Hey, if you ever need somebody spur of the moment, last minute, call me." And about 2 months later, they said, "We've got 6 airplanes to pick up tomorrow in Wichita and 5 pilots. You want to go?" And I go, "Yeah." So went back to Wichita to the Cessna factory and flew back. And we did the northern route, which means you land in Pueblo, Colorado, you cross the Rockies and into Utah for your next fuel stop. And we ran into some weather crossing the Rockies. And the owner of the company was in one of the airplanes. He goes, tell you what, Heidi, if you can lead us out of here and find Milford, Utah, you've got a job. And so that was incentive. And we made it there, and I never became a flight instructor because ferrying airplanes and delivering them, I mean, you rack up a lot of hours really fast. And so I started doing domestic ferry flights. I told them, don't even consider me for overwater because you guys are out of your minds. You know, I will do Wichita to California as much as you want, but no way. And
of course, those are the days before GPS. And so when you're out there leading them to an airport, you're finding it by what, dead reckoning, a couple of VORs along the way.
Yeah. But in the Rockies, there weren't a lot of places. So I don't know how I did it, but like I said, I did good incentive. But yeah. And then I got to know the other pilots, and I'd hear them talking about Fiji and Honolulu and Ponape. And I've always been fascinated with World War II. And so after I thought, well, I might try it just once, just to say I've done it, and then check off that box. And I absolutely fell in love with it. Loved it.
And that was when the international flying began.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, we'll pause that because we'll come back to your story on it. But tell me a little bit then about where your career went after ferry flying and what pushed you, you know, towards the airlines and what that story was about.
Yes, I was always, you know, looking for the next job that would get me bigger airplanes, better experience. And I got a job in Denver flying for Pioneer Airline. They flew Beech 99s and Metroliners. And it was a pretty big operation. They served 42 cities in 7 states. And I got a job with them. And about 7 months later, I got an interview with Republic Airline in Minneapolis. And they were, Republic was formed by Southern Airways, Hughes Air West, and North Central. And I got a job and was put right into DC-9s. And then shortly thereafter, Republic merged with Northwest Orient to become Northwest. And then years later, Northwest merged with Delta. And so that's where I retired with Delta as a 330 captain.
What was it like making the leap up to DC-9s from what you'd been flying before that?
It was my first jet. And
DC-9 was your first jet?
It was my first jet, yep. And they had a fabulous hiring and training program. So when you went for your interview, that night at midnight, you would go to their simulator, and having no jet experience, I was paired up with another applicant. They put me on the jump seat in the simulator to watch what the protocol was. And they gave me power settings and all of that. And so they just basically want to see if the experience level you put on your application matches your flying skills in the simulator. And yeah, it was great. And the training program was phenomenal. And so my first lesson out of training, out of the simulators, was an airplane full of passengers.
Yeah, that, you know, it's one thing that I think a lot of people don't necessarily understand, that a lot of times, even in today's world, the first time that someone's actually flying one of those big jets, it's there's paying passengers in the back.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we try to keep that quiet.
We'll pretend we didn't let that secret out.
Yes. Yeah.
Tell me a little bit about the aircraft that you flew during your airline career.
I started in the DC-9, which my class was very small. There were only 8 of us. And so we were kind of lucky because the class before us that had 20-some, they all went to the flight engineer panel on the 727, and the class after us went to the Convair 580. So we were lucky in that there were only eight of us, so they put us right into the DC-9. And I flew four different models of DC-9, and they all had different flight characteristics and the way you land them. So that was good training. And then from the right seat of the DC-9, I went to the right seat of the Airbus 320. And then the left seat, captain on the DC-9, and then captain on the 320. And then I decided I really wanted international experience, but I didn't want, even though I was a captain, I didn't want my first experience to be in the left seat of a wide body that I hadn't flown before. So I took a demotion and I flew the right seat of the 747-400. I flew that for 15 years. It was amazing, absolutely amazing. I love that airplane. And then when they decided to retire the fleet, I went back to, I went to the 330, which is the Airbus wide body in the right seat, and then upgraded to captain on that.
Wow. So if you had to describe in brief what it's like to captain a 747, like Queen of the Skies, what would you say?
Every takeoff and every landing, I would say, I can't believe I'm doing this. I mean, it was incredible. And the plane's been around for a long time, but still I do a walk around and the tires are like up to here, and you just never get over how massive that thing is. And it was so easy to fly, very forgiving. And also what I loved about it was we typically had four pilots, two full crews. And there was such camaraderie and everybody was helping you out. And it was a very unique experience, but it was a real joy. I hated to see them retire that airplane. It was amazing.
The last aircraft that you and I have talked about offline that you flew was the Gulfstream. Mm-hmm. Tell me a little bit about the difference when you got a chance to fly a high power corporate jet.
Yeah, after I retired this wasn't a corporate job. It was a private couple that owned this Gulfstream, and they brought me on. I knew their chef. He was my neighbor, and so he said, "Hey, we need a new pilot. You know, give me your resume." And okay, 3 weeks later, I was at flight safety, going to school. So it was an eye opener. That thing is so high performance and powerful that the first takeoff, I was about 5 seconds behind. Not my takeoff, I was watching. But the power, it slammed me back into my seat, and the climb was amazing. And it's got all the glass instrumentation, and it was the first Gulfstream that incorporated the side stick. So I was used to that. You could see the curvature of the earth. We could go up to our ceiling was 51,000 feet. Wow. Which the highest I had ever been before was 40,000, but I never took it up to 51. I think the highest was 49, but even so it was pretty, it was kind of like a rocket ship. That's what it felt like.
That's amazing. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So obviously, one of the amazing story that you looked through was the ditching that you did. So take me through a little bit. Let's go back to your ferry days and take us through a little bit of what happened.
I was on my 10th delivery, which I never like to use that number because that equates to really over 60 overwater flights. Our shortest leg was about 800 miles, and our longest leg was 2,600 miles. So each leg was really an ocean crossing. And I was paired up with a 172. I was in a 182 fixed gear, And about 11 hours into the flight, I noticed a little drop in the oil pressure, which is not unusual when the engine's been running that long. And after about 20 minutes, I noticed it was down another 5 PSI. And I started thinking, this is not normal. And I asked my wingman, who was my boss at the time, to check the undercarriage of my plane, see if he saw anything abnormal, smoke or oil, anything, and he didn't.
So let me just interrupt for 1 second to make sure. First of all, I did put up a map of what your typical legs were so people can see that. Mm-hmm. But I want to be clear. So you, when you do those long overwaters, you're not completely solo out there. You have someone else, you're doing more than one aircraft at the same time. When you say your wingman?
Yes, we tried to go in groups of airplanes whenever we could. You were always solo in the airplane because the whole cockpit was taken up with fuel tanks.
Right.
However, I did do a couple of solo crossings as well. But sometimes you'd be paired up with a light twin and you'd be in a single, so that the single engine would take off first for a couple of hours, and then the twin would take off, and then you'd at least have someone to talk to for mm-hmm. the majority of the flight. But we tried to go over in groups whenever possible.
Got yeah. it. And this shows what you did, as you said, the typical. Can you take us through the map real quick before you?
Yeah, the first leg there from California, we normally took off out of Oakland, and that was to Honolulu. And that is the longest stretch of open water in the world, where there's no land that is any closer to divert to, except turning around and going back from your departure or continuing to your destination. The second leg from Honolulu, and this shows a little dog leg, but actually most of our flights went straight from Honolulu down to Pango Pango or American Samoa. And that was actually our longest flight. It's 2,600 miles and took about 18 hours, typically. But if you ran into trouble, there were islands you could divert to. We didn't fly over any land on that leg, but you could divert somewhere if you ran into trouble. And then from there, we'd go to a place called Norfolk Island, which is where the O is in the word south down there, and then on to Sydney, or from Pango Pango, we'd go down to New Zealand. So in 4 days, we'd fly about 54 hours.
Wow. How do you stay awake and alert for 18 hours of flying?
I was pretty worried about that my first trip. And what I discovered was that we would take off between 2 and 3 in the morning, right about a half hour before sunup, you'd get this wave of fatigue. But once the sun came up, you were good. And then about every 4 hours, it would go in waves. So I was worried that once you got tired, you were gonna stay that tired for the rest of the flight, but it went in cycles. So you learn to get over the hump. You know, sometimes we'd fly formation with one another. On one airplane, I delivered an ag husky, a crop duster, once down to Australia, which did not have an autopilot. And I was really getting tired. So I took my shoes and socks off and I dropped a pencil. And then it took me about 20 minutes to pick up the pencil with my toes. And that got me overwhelmed. So you learn tricks of the trade, or you talk to airliners if there are any around. Or yeah, there's the ag husky. And because I had tail dragger experience from towing, I was the one that got the ag husky going down. And I took a bungee cord as my autopilot. So I hooked it over on the right side of the instrument panel. I wrapped it around the stick and then hooked it, but it was a little bit too tight. So slowly the nose would start pitching over, but it allowed me to let go for about 45 seconds, you know, enough to plot my position on a chart and take engine readings, stuff like that.
Wow. But And this was the aircraft, is that correct?
Yes, that was the one that I put in the water. Yeah.
And not a lot of room other than you.
No, we were allowed to be 30% over max gross weight by the FAA in order to carry enough fuel to make the flights. And we never took off unless we had a minimum of 2.5 hour fuel reserve. Wow. And like you said, this was before iPhones, GPS, all of that. So on top of that fuel tank, the receiver to the left was a Loran C, which was really meant for maritime use. It was accurate to within 20 to 30 miles. And some of these islands were only like 9 miles long and 6 miles across, but there were no Loran stations beyond Hawaii. So it was all dead reckoning after that.
Wow. That's amazing. All right. So where we left off, your oil pressure is dropping, but he didn't see anything.
Correct. And he, you know, said, he asked me, well, is the oil temp increasing? And it wasn't. So he thought it might be an indication problem, but my little voice was saying, this is abnormal. So he said, well, Heidi, what do you want to do? I said, I think I better call a Mayday. And he goes, well, go ahead. Like, that's not what I would do, but if you want. So I was really nervous about this because you call a Mayday and all kinds of stuff starts happening. You don't want to do it haphazardly. So I had never called the Mayday before. I'd seen it in the movies and it seemed too surreal to me. So I was nervous and I picked up the microphone for the HF radio and to Honolulu, and my hand was shaking, my voice was shaking. And I said, Honolulu radio, Cessna 8032 Mike, with a possible Mayday. I didn't do Mayday, Mayday, Mayday. And at the same time I'm making this call, there was a Navy P3 Orion nearby, and they were listening in on the emergency frequency. And the captain, or he was a lieutenant commander, he turned to his co-pilot and says, what is a possible Mayday? You're either pregnant or you're not, you know? So they continued to listen. And I explained my situation and they go, that's a bona fide Mayday. So after I was done talking to Honolulu with all the information, they called me and they said, we remember hearing you give a position fix a little while ago. You want us to turn around, see if we can locate you. Yeah, that would be nice. So they turned around. I gave them what coordinates I had according to the Loran, but like I said, it's plus or minus 20 miles. I'm a little speck. But a few minutes later, I saw a contrail coming up ahead. And we always would fly on the leg between California and Hawaii. We would fly westbound at low altitude, 5,000 or 6,000 feet, on a high altitude eastbound airway. And that way we would see all the contrails of airline traffic going from Hawaii back to the mainland. And we could get position fixes from them. So we would call them on 121.5, which the airlines monitor. And I said, are you near this intersection? Can you do an S turn for me so I know it's you I'm talking to? And he did, and the contrail broke. And I told him when he was directly overhead and from their navigation equipment, they gave me a latitude, longitude. I gave that to the P3. And about 15 minutes later, P3 had me in sight. Wow. So that was a huge comfort to me because they were helping coordinate with Coast Guard search and rescue and giving them a lot of information. So that was good. Now, all this time, the oil pressure is still very slowly dropping, but the oil temp stayed normal. So I took this time to start preparing for a possible ditching. And I read the operating manual, but the procedures they had one for a ditching, but, and then one for a forced landing engine failure. So I kind of joined the two of them and then added a few items of my own. And I read those off to my wingman to read to me at the appropriate time. I didn't want to have to be flying and look at a checklist, and I just wanted to focus on the flying, and that ended up working out well. The P3, they were at 15,000 feet. They had descended down to 15. I was initially at 6,000 and decided to climb up to 8,500 feet to give myself a little extra breathing room in a descent. And from their altitude, they could see the swells much better. So they gave me a better heading to fly, and one that went to Hilo instead of Honolulu, which was a little closer. And their advice to me was, Heidi, if you have to ditch, you should stall the airplane. And that's the safest way to survive the impact, because you're going the slowest forward momentum. And you saw the picture of the cockpit. Yeah. On top of the tank, I had a four-man life raft, which was in a fairly large rectangular bundle. And I wanted to use that as an airbag. My biggest concern in surviving the impact was not hitting the side of my head on the edge of the gas tank. And I thought, if I have to stall the airplane and I stall too high, it could cartwheel and I'd hit the side of my head on the edge of that tank. And so I disagreed with them and I said, I'm going to carry a few knots of airspeed so I still have control over the bank. If I can keep the wings level, hopefully the mains will touch down at the same time. Well, to make this more challenging, in order to have enough room in my lap for the life raft, I had to move my seat all the way back. I could no longer reach the rudder pedals. I'm blind off the right because of everything on top of the gas tanks. I couldn't see over the nose anymore. I could only look out the left window. So that made it even more challenging to keep the wings level and hopefully touch down both mains at the same time. So the engine eventually did quit, and I had never had an engine failure before. And I asked Earl, I said, what can I expect? You know, and he said, oh, you'll know. There'll be a lot of surging. You'll hear loud noises coming from the engine. And yeah, you're going to know when it's about to quit. Well, I heard a tap, 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 and a, and that was it. The engine quit. So it's very subtle. I immediately reverted back to glider. It was just a big glider, and it felt completely natural. And on the way down, I had Earl read off the checklist to me. I decided to open the door and window on the left ahead of time, because if the plane did cartwheel and the fuselage might torque, I could be trapped. And carried a few extra knots airspeed. And I hit going 63 knots. The mains touched down and bounced, but everything kept going straight. And then the nose hit and grabbed, and it flipped onto its back. But everything kept going straight. And I grayed out from the deceleration. And I don't swim.
You don't swim?
Well, I can do the dog paddle and I can do the side stroke. When I was a little girl, I was 4 years old, we're at a big party and they had a built-in swimming pool. And while everybody was eating, I went around back and I fell into the pool. And I didn't know how to swim. And by the time they found me and dragged me out, I was clinically dead. And there was one person at this party that worked for the Red Cross who had just learned this new technique called CPR. And that's what saved me. But I've always had a fear of the water. I was really crazy to do this for a living.
I was going to say, like, nice choice of profession if you're camping in our crate of water, like nothing in sight. But wow. Now, were you trying to land in line with the swells, or what is it that you try to do in that circumstance?
They recommended, with the conditions as they were, yes, to land with the swell. But I really had no control when it was going to touch down. And because I couldn't see forward, I couldn't maneuver to get, you know, everything's going like this. So it was luck, you know.
So what was it like getting out?
I was upside down underwater, and I can't open my eyes underwater. Never have been able to. And the sensation was that I was sinking very rapidly. I wasn't. I think my feet were above water, but it felt like the whole plane was sinking. And I was very disoriented. But I knew that there was a gas tank on one side and a door on the other. And so I just took my arms and pushed them outwards. And my right hand hit the gas tank and my left hand hit the door, and it just swung open. And so that's how I knew to go in that direction. And once I put the raft in my lap, there's a lanyard that you can pull out from a flap on the side. And I had taken that and wrapped it around my waist so that if the raft went out the door on impact, I'd still be able to pull it back to me. And I just started moving, and I could tell through my closed eyelids that it was getting brighter and brighter. I think I was underwater maybe 15 seconds in all.
That's a lot.
But I flash back to the same sensations I had when I fell in that swimming pool, you know, because as the plane pitched forward, I remember hearing myself gasp, you know, I went, and in that breath, I had water. So I think the windshield blew out. It was just an explosion of water. And I could taste it and I could feel it going down my throat. And, you know, so I went through this mental argument, like, Heidi, nobody's going to pull you out of this one. You're not in the swimming pool. Get moving. Get out. And so that's what I did. And now the luxury of ditching a high-wing airplane upside down is now it's a low-wing airplane. So I had something to stand on. And it actually, the fixed gear made it easier to get out, because had it been a retractable, it would have skinned the surface and then settled, and I would have had to get out the door and then out from underneath the wing to get to air. So with it upside down, it made it much faster to get my head above water. Yeah.
Did it remain floating for quite some time?
It was, I would say, above the surface for about a half hour. The engine slowly brought the plane vertical before it disappeared, and the ferry tanks were pretty much empty by that time. So I think that's what helped it stay buoyant. But I had no idea how fast the plane was going to go down, and I had a big problem in getting into the raft. I inflated it, and it was inflating upside down, so I had to correct that. You know, my raft is the same raft that Tom Hanks used in Castaway. So it was one tube with a floor, and I got on the wing. I inflated, pulled the tabs on my life vest, but all it did was unfold. It didn't inflate. And I thought, well, don't worry about it. Just get in the raft first and then worry about that. So I dog paddled to where the raft was, and I put my torso close to that tube and pushed up to get into the raft. There was no little rope ladder or anything for getting into the raft. And I got about halfway in, I get pulled back into the water. And after two or three attempts, I couldn't figure out what's going on. I looked down and I could see that that lanyard was wrapped around my ankle and it must have been caught to the airframe somewhere. So I get half the slack, the slack taken out and I get pulled back in. So I had to go back to the wing, untangle my ankle. Now the raft is kind of drifting away. I dog paddle back to the raft. Every ounce of energy I had to get into that raft, and had my vest inflated when I first pulled those tabs, I wouldn't have been able to get into the raft without taking it off, because I needed my body close to that tube to get the leverage I needed to lift my body up. With a big vest in front of me, I would not have had that leverage. So that was a blessing. And then once I got into the raft, I thought, okay, I'm set. Now I can maneuver back to the cockpit and get all my supplies. I carried a Air Force flight helmet bag that had all these pockets, and I had a flare gun and a radio and you name it. And I was trying to maneuver the raft, and it wasn't getting any closer to the cockpit. And then I heard a noise and I looked, and the rudder of the airplane was rubbing against the raft. That lanyard was still caught to the airframe and it was pinning the raft to the rudder. And I thought, it's going to puncture the raft. So I had minimum supplies prepackaged in the raft. And one of the items was a knife, which is about as sharp as a butter knife, but I managed to get the knife out of its compartment and just kept sawing away at the rope. I didn't know how fast the plane was going to sink. And I thought, if I don't cut this lanyard, it's going to pull the raft down and me with it. So I was finally able to cut the lanyard and immediately started drifting away. And that's this picture that you see here. So I did not have oars in the raft, and I wasn't able to maneuver back to the airplane to get my extra supplies. And because I was no longer attached to the raft, there was no way I was going to leave it and swim over and try and get supplies and swim back, because I had such a hard time getting in the first place. So I just had the minimum supplies that was packaged.
Wow. And this is the Orion?
No, well, the P3 Orion took these photos. It was about 20 minutes later that a C-130 Hercules from the Coast Guard came out. They were already airborne on another mission when they got the call, so they couldn't stay long, but they dropped smoke flares. So that's what you see at the top of the picture. And that tells them what the wind direction is on the surface. And they had a 30-man life raft. I called it a Marriott. And a large bundle of supplies. And it's connected by a very long rope. And the idea is that you see what the wind is doing on the surface. You drop it upwind of your target. And as it drifts towards you, all the person has to do is grab that rope, pull the raft bundle to them, inflate it, and then you've got the supplies. So great. So these bundles landed in the water, and I'm looking at them and I'm thinking, I'm not a very good swimmer. I'm not attached to the raft anymore. I do have a life vest, but I don't know. I think I better stay put and just hope that the supplies I have are good enough. And when I got back to Honolulu, I had a debriefing with both the Navy and the Coast Guard. And both of them, the very first question they asked me was, when those supplies were dropped to you, why didn't you swim for them? And I explained why. And they said, thank God, because about 30 seconds after we dropped the supplies, we said, you're dead. Because anybody else would have tried to swim for them and they wouldn't have made it. the current was going the opposite direction and taking it away from me. So another blessing.
Wow.
Yeah, so then they had to leave, and my wingman, of course, he followed me down in my 5 o'clock position, and I had told him I would signal him once I got into the raft. So I said, Earl, if I get in the raft and I wave both arms to you, it means I'm not hurt, raft's in good shape, no worries, keep going. If I get in the raft and I wave one arm, it means I'm hurt, but not seriously, maybe a cracked rib, broken, but basically everything's okay. Keep going. If I get in the raft and I don't wave my arms, it means I'm hurt seriously. I don't know how long I'm gonna last and somebody needs to get in the water with me. And if I don't get in the raft, you know, that's that. So the first call my family got was, you know, Heidi's ditched, she's not hurt, raft is in good shape, location's pinpointed, help is on the way. And just kind of answered all their questions off, right off the bat. So then he made two circles and then kept going. So there's nothing else he could do.
He's on limited fuel. Yeah.
Pardon me?
And he's on limited fuel.
Correct. Now, if the P3 had not located me, he would have circled and stayed on target until he had maybe an hour, 45 minutes to an hour fuel, and then continue on. He would hopefully stay till somebody else had me in sight. But fortunately, that wasn't the case. Yeah. So yeah, I'm sitting in the raft and now everybody's gone. The P3 had to leave and they had shut down two engines in order to stay with me. So they had to go back to Hawaii to refuel. They were headed to California. And you kind of go through stages. You know, first you're kind of numb. You know, it's like I had no emotions. You load shed what you don't need to take care of the problem. And, you know, it's like, oh, so this is what it's like to ditch in the middle of the ocean, you know. And then you go through anger and then worry. You know, I was worried about my family and what they must be going through. And then I realized where I was in relation to the mileage. And a year and a half earlier, I had lost what would have been my fiance in a ditching in the same spot, but he didn't make it. And when I first realized that, I turned my head and there was a brown seagull about 20 feet away. I don't know where he came from, but I just felt this peace, like he was watching out for me and everything would be okay. And then just nothing. And then, you know, just sitting there and wondering how long it would be till I would get picked up. And the last word I had heard was that a destroyer was coming out from Pearl Harbor. But I knew that would take over 24 hours. I was 540 miles from Hawaii. So I was surprised as to who actually picked me up.
And who
want me
was
to
that?
Tell you? Well, midnight came, and this happened at 2 p.m. The weather was getting worse. The swells by that time were 10 to 12 feet. And I thought, another half hour, I'm going to capsize. But more airplanes started coming out and dropping flares. And then I saw a very bright white light on the horizon, and I knew it was a ship. And by the time it got close enough to me, it was still like a quarter of a mile away. Most of the time I couldn't see this big ship because I'd be on the backside of a swell. So I thought, how are they going to see me? And I, in the package of supplies, I had one handheld rocket flare and I didn't want to fire it until I knew they were looking it in my direction. So if they were looking the opposite direction, they might miss it altogether. So they had two searchlights on the upper deck. but I was beyond the range of their light. But I waited till they were both pointed towards me, and I fired the flare, and the ship started moving away. And that was the worst of everything, because I thought, I'm not going to make it. I'm going to capsize. Wow. Well, they were just looking in another area. Well, at the same time, these airplanes were circling overhead, and they were talking to a ship, and they were saying, turn to the right. She's right in front of you. Turn to the right. She's right in front of you. Turn to the right. And the ship came back and said, we've just done a 360-degree right-hand turn. We don't see her. Well, the ship they were looking at hadn't budged. The ship they were talking to had been given the wrong coordinates, and they were 20 miles south. But in all the comings and goings of the aircraft, they assumed the ship they were looking at was the one they were talking to. So this ship, all they were doing was following flares that were being dropped by airplanes. They knew somebody was in trouble, but they didn't know if it was an airline or a sailboat, a cruise ship. They had no idea. So finally, I didn't have any flares left, but I heard the sound of an engine, a launch, and I had a whistle that was packaged in the supplies. And I blew that whistle till I thought my cheeks would rip open. And the launch homed in on the whistle and found me and threw me a line. And they pulled me up and went below, and everybody's talking, and I don't understand the language. And finally, I just said, American. He goes, Ruski. And I said, can I use profanity?
Yeah.
I said, oh, shit. This was 1984, and it was the Cold War. So, and that's why airplanes couldn't talk to it, because they didn't share frequencies during the Cold War. So, long story long, I ended up staying on their ship for about 3 hours until they were finally able to get in touch with the American ship that was 20 miles away, and they coordinated a rendezvous, and I was transferred over, and 27 hours later I was at Pearl Harbor.
Oh, so, wow.
That's
Do you know what was the name of the ship?
Yuriskaya Taiga was the name of the Soviet ship, and they're based out of Vladivostok. And this is the Meteor, the USNS Meteor, which is, they call it a gray ship. It's a Navy ship with a civil service crew. Under the Maritime Sea Lift Command, I believe is the proper department. And that's at Pearl Harbor. And so they were fabulous. They were great. Yeah. And then once I got home, the P-3 crew were a reserve unit based out of Moffett Field in the Bay Area, and they had a ceremony for me and made me an honorary naval aviator, which made my father very happy, because I had wanted to fly in the military, but they didn't allow women at the time to fly, and they gave me a citation from the Department of the Navy, and that was a real highlight of my life and meeting all of them.
Wow. Yeah. That's truly, truly amazing story. And just incredible. I mean, what were some of your biggest takeaways that you look back on your life from that?
What surprised me the most was, I think everybody as a pilot, they might think about, how would I handle an emergency? How would I handle an engine failure? And at the right before impact, at the very last second, would you, you know, brace yourself, which is a reflex, you have no control. And what I found out about myself was when the plane came to a stop upside down in the water, I still had both hands on the yoke. So that was comforting. The other thing was, in an emergency, all kinds of information comes back to you that you swear, like, where did that come from? And one incident, I was very sick from all the salt water I'd swallowed during impact. So I was vomiting a bit. And after I got sick the first time in the water, and I thought, oh, shoot, do I have any internal injuries? And I remembered seeing a documentary on sharks and how they can home in on the tiniest bit of blood for incredible distances. And so I didn't want to risk putting any bodily fluids in the water. So I emptied a supply bag. So what I learned, there were other incidences, but you find out how strong you are and how, like I said, information will come to you when you need it. And also the generosity of people that will do anything to help you. And it doesn't matter the nationality, that you need help, there are going to be people that will help you. And that's pretty comforting.
Wow. Well, that's a truly, truly amazing story. And I'm grateful certainly that you are with us tonight, not just here on the show, but that you're still with us in general after this amazing experience. There's just so much to it, and as you and I have spoken about in the past, there's so much more also to your experience and all the wonderful stories and things you've done through your ferry pilot days. I hope you'll consider coming back and talking with us about the rest of that as well, because your adventures on the flight deck, your adventures in the cockpit of ferrying aircraft, are really a pilot's pilot story and collection of so many wonderful experiences. I'm really, really grateful. Thank you so much.
This was so much fun. I really enjoyed it. I'd love to come back sometime. So
absolutely, absolutely. It'd be wonderful. So again, thank you so much for taking time to join us here on Social Flight Live. It's an amazing story. To anyone else out there, please go and check out Heidi's book, Ditching the Sky, where you can get a lot more detail on this and her experience, which I think we probably barely did it justice for everything that you've been through in such a short period of time that we had this evening. But I wanted to give people certainly a bit of a taste of what your experience really is. And again, I look forward to having you back where we can talk about so many more of your adventures.
Yes, thank you so much. This has been great. I really enjoyed myself.
Absolutely. Well, have a wonderful, wonderful evening, Heidi, and we will chat again soon.
All right. Take care.
Thank you. And to all of you, thank you so much for taking time out of your evening to join us here on Social Flight Live. We will be off next week and then back November 4th, Tuesday, November 4th, with Mike Bush of Savvy Aviation. Mike is probably the best well-known AMP mechanic IA in all of general aviation. We're going to talk about mishaps after maintenance and a lot of the research that he has done and is continuing to do to find ways of mapping out what can we do about maintenance-induced failures that happen so frequently, unfortunately, after major maintenance on aircraft. So again, that's November 4th, Tuesday, November 4th, here on Social Flight Live. Then the following week on Tuesday, November 11th, we have our Cockpit to Cowl show with Brian Schiff, where Brian and I go and kind of talk about from the flight instructor perspective and airline pilot perspective from his, and the maintenance perspective from my expertise. And we're going to answer your questions. That's what we're going to do, a dedicated show to answering your questions. That is Tuesday, November 11th. Go to cockpit2cowl.com to register for that show. Until next time, again, thank you so much for joining us here on Social Flight Live. And I wish you all blue skies.